from the campus of Gonzaga University in Spokane, Washington. You're listening to the G Suite Podcast, where we discuss all things Zag business.
Ryan Herzog is an associate professor of economics at Gonzaga and is a co-author of one of the top college textbooks, Principles of Economics, with Nobel laureate Paul Krugman. Dr. Herzog's expertise have been featured on various media outlets, including CBS, Bloomberg, Cheddar, and the CBC.
Today we have Dr. Ryan Herzog with us, and we're going to take a unique approach to this pod and kind of talk about some current issues in economics, if you will. But welcome, Ryan. Always good to see you, buddy.
Appreciate you finally having me on. It's been a while. I've been feeling a little left out, but it's fun to talk economics.
I wanted to have you on months ago, but Stephanie was opposed.
What?
So
you can't just throw me under the bus like that.
On your birthday, no less.
On my birthday, yeah.
Yeah. And fun news, you're going to, when do you go out to London again? You told me.
Sunday.
Sunday?
A couple days from now.
Are you on that red eye out of Seattle?
Mm-mm. I'm going to Paris first for a couple days.
Oh, perfect.
And then I'll take a train over.
Good for you.
Yeah.
Good for you. Yeah. Stephanie's going on our London trek over spring break, which is pretty awesome. Taking students to go meet some potential employers in London. But that's not what we're here to talk about today. So just by way of background, Dr. Herzog, he has been with us for, 15, 16 years, maybe?
16 years.
16 glorious years. And he, I don't know what the term would be. I want to say co-authors. Is that what you'd say?
Contributing author, yes.
Contributing author for a textbook with Nobel laureate Paul Krugman. And Paul and his wife are also personal friends. So we're bringing the heavy hitters out today for the Gonzaga community to get some insights into kind of what you're reading in the headlines. When I open up Washington Post or Wall Street Journal, it's just, I can't believe the pace of things that are happening. And what we want today is kind of an economics expert's view and impact and potential impact on a lot of the things happening. So we'd like to start out, Dr. Herzog, going back a few years and maybe pre-COVID scenario. And I don't know if you want to go all the way back to 2008, 2009, but kind of set the stage for where we were at when the pandemic hit.
Yeah, I think it's a good conversation to have because to understand where we are today and what's going on today and people's perception of the economy, I think we have to go back to right before the pandemic. And that's the perception most people have of what is a good economy, right? 2019, summer of 2019 into winter, the economy was pretty good. Unemployment rates were down to 3.5%. Interest rates were relatively low. People felt very optimistic. We do all these surveys of people's perception of the economy. How is it doing? And everyone felt the economy was doing fairly well, very optimistic. And the hope was that was going to continue. And I think it's important to kind of put that in our frame of mind of what the economy was, because the last 5 years have been a roller coaster. And I think people are hoping to someday get back to what the stability was in 2018-19. And I don't know if that's a realistic kind of option. I don't think that's where what our goals are or should be today. But I think that's what people are always comparing today to, right? So, I think that's an important kind of framework to have in mind of where we are today. What's realistic? What should we expect over the next few years?
Curious about this word perception, because sometimes perception doesn't match reality. And you use it a couple of times in your response from the economist's standpoint. So are we looking at kind of how I feel about my economic security, which could be sometimes different than data like unemployment or something along that lines. But can you elaborate a little bit when you say perception?
Yeah. So I think when we talk about the economy, we tend, especially as a macroeconomist, we tend to talk about the economy in the kind of the overall aggregate. Economic growth is 3%, and unemployment is 3.5%, inflation is 2%. And when the economy is relatively good, most people kind of see those numbers, they don't pay much attention to, and they go, oh yeah, I feel pretty good about myself. I feel pretty good. I think the economy is doing well. I see my wages going up. I don't feel like I'm being left behind. And then COVID hits, and there was left and right shocks that people had to respond to. Whether it was job loss due to your company having to shut down temporarily, all sorts of kind of economic shocks hit us at once. And the ultimate culmination of those shocks, right, was a government response that resulted in trillions of dollars being handed out, whether it was in household tax credits, whether it was in the PPP, the payroll protection payment plan, or there was some wage tax credits that were given to employers that kept staff.
Go on, sir.
We're talking tax, right?
Now I know what you're talking about.
So there was a bunch of stimulus measures that were put into effect, and people felt largely pretty good about the economy during COVID. Equity, home prices were booming, the stock market was booming, wage growth, especially at the lower end of the wage spectrum, was skyrocketing. Spring, summer of 21, the economy started to reopen, everyone was hiring, and it was just sort of a picturesque moment of the economy because everyone was feeling pretty good about it. And then everything kind of came to a halt when inflation a year later peaked up there close to 9%. And that's when I think we saw this divide in the reality and people's perception. The government kept saying inflation's 9%, inflation's 9%, inflation's 9%. And people didn't believe the data. So I think we have this kind of divide in what the economic data are saying and what people are experiencing. And when the data are good, people's experience doesn't usually differ much from the average, right? Because most people kind of could get to enjoy the good economy. But when the economy is bad, or an element of the economy is bad, in this case, inflation, people are experiencing that in many different ways. And you know, some basic examples, where you lived had a big impact on the type of inflation you kind of experienced. If you lived in areas of this country that were kind of hot housing markets, so Phoenix, Dallas, Florida, Boise, Idaho, Reno, Nevada, where they took this huge inflow of people, inflation in those cities was significantly higher, upwards of, so, and from the kind of end of the pandemic to the kind of where we are today, average prices in the US have gone up about 20-25% as a whole. But you look at some of these other cities, their experience of inflation is upwards of 35% or more. And so they're seeing home prices double. They're seeing prices of services increase significantly because people moved into these cities and started demanding services where they just didn't have the labor to fill the jobs.
Okay.
And so then people in a lot of these sort of hot home cities started kind of really discrediting, no, I don't believe this data. I don't think it's the right data. It doesn't match the situation I'm in. And they started discrediting a lot of the macro data. And then you did have people in other cities, San Francisco, New York, Chicago, kind of more of the urban, tied into some of the election stuff, more blue cities where people were leaving. And the demand for services in those cities wasn't as big. And ultimately, prices, they went up, but by a fraction of the amount as some of these kind of hotter southern cities experience. And so you have this now like growing economic divide in how is the economy, right? You have one side that sees inflation significantly higher than the government's reporting, really not trusting the economic data. And you have one side that sort of says, yeah, I can see that. That fits what I'm doing. And there's already this difficulty in getting people to kind of understand what inflation is, because we typically see inflation in these one-time price increases that we like to extrapolate to everything. So it's always hard to get people to realize inflation's more than just the gas prices you're paying, right? Because we see those prices every day we drive home. It's more than just the pound of meat you bought at the grocery store, or you know, your car insurance rates that just came in, or recently in Spokane, your utilities bill, right? That's one element of it, but people tend to respond to those things more as that's what everything's doing, right? And so they see inflation much higher than what it is. And so that kind of creates this, like I was saying, this divide between, well, what's the reality versus what people's perceptions are. And so you have people talking about the economy's really, really good. And people are going, no, it's not. It's like, look at what we're experiencing. It's not aligning with our experiences.
So if I understand you correctly, you're probably leaning towards the right side of the political spectrum if you're moving from California to Reno or to some of these quote-unquote Texas cities. I think you mentioned.
You could throw in Dallas. You could throw in Nashville. You can throw in Florida, Atlanta, Georgia.
And their experience higher inflation. So their perception on the right side of this versus, okay, that makes sense. Go ahead. Sorry.
I was going to ask too, because I was in Fort Wayne, Indiana, which is the second largest city in all of Indiana, but it's about 270,000 in the population of the greater Fort Wayne area. We had a lot of people moving in. So during that time too, and we saw those house prices go up and double and all of that. So I'm wondering, was it just big cities that people were moving to, or were they just trying to look for affordability?
I think you had a lot of people use COVID as an opportunity to move into a community that more surrounded with your ideals. And part of that is your political ideals. People moved kind of outwards a little bit. If you were in an urban city and you tended to be more conservative in Seattle or San Francisco or Los Angeles, these people moved from Seattle, maybe out to the suburbs of Seattle. From the suburbs of Seattle, they moved out to Spokane, Coeur d'Alene, Boise. In Portland, they moved out to Bend, or they moved out to Boise. And so you kind of had people move from cities. In Fort Wayne, I would imagine a lot of it would have been potentially people in the Chicago suburbs move out to, again, affordability. They were able to sell their homes and take out a lot of equity with them and move into a lower cost of living area, which of course then drives up the cost of living for those that are living in the lower cost living area. And it makes it harder for them to sustain a lifestyle that they'd come accustomed to.
That makes a lot of sense. I think anecdotally, that's what I had heard too, is that it was, you know, maybe folks who grew up there and then they moved away to those big cities, Chicago, Indianapolis, wherever it may have been. And then during the pandemic, being in a high cost of living, a small space, they could afford so much more. So they moved back to where they were from, or other people found it on a list of like very affordable places to live. Mm-hmm. And so, I mean, I knew people who moved from New York or like from Manhattan, like the actual big cities. And I thought, really, this is quite a difference in the pace just from trying to find a place that's more affordable to live. But I do see your point on political spectrum.
Well, and so that, yeah. So, I mean, that's part of it. Yeah. I mean, there's all sorts of elements that drive why people move. Mm-hmm. At the end of the day, you ended up with some communities that when the government comes out says inflation's, 6.5% this year. Oh yeah, that makes sense. I kind of experienced that. And others that are like, I don't buy it. It's not true. And it builds into a lot of these conspiracies around government's cooking the books or the data is not accurate. And it was designed to sort of discredit the data. And the data are what the data are. It's just our experiences now are so divided. When you have the mean here, but people are living on the tails, no one's actually experiencing the average anymore. Right. And that's a problem, right? And then fast forward a little bit, you get to sort of the election cycle and you get people... if you look at economic issues, the two things that people cared about were inflation and home prices. And at the end of the day, when people went to vote, they made a decision on, were we better off today than where we were 4 years ago? And because of all these kind of big shocks on pricing and everything else, We could try to say, oh, but your wages have gone up faster. Didn't matter, right? At the end of the day, they saw, right, the prices of these kind of big ticket items have these one-time shocks, and they felt they weren't better off. And the irony of this is, if you look at pre-election and you survey households and you ask them, and we've done this, we have this data, and you ask them, how do you feel about your own personal financial situation? More than 70% of this country feels actually good and well and happy about their own personal financial situation. But then we extend that bubble out and we ask you, how do you feel about your local economic situation? And about half think it's good or fairly well or good. And then we ask them, well, how do you think about the national economic situation? And about 80% think it's poor or not good. So we tend to kind of, again, that sort of extrapolates my perception versus reality. We even then hear other stories because you get this, you know, I'm in a social media effect, right? Someone has this experience and all of a sudden they can post something on social media, it goes viral, and people are like, oh yeah, I had something similar. And all of a sudden now there's just this belief that the economic realities are so very different. And that's what I think ultimately drove people to kind of vote for a little bit of a change in how our economy is structured. And in comes the election, and President Trump obviously wins. And now we're at today, which I think you have to turn on the news about every
right. And well, but let's hold on that. Okay. I want to follow up real quick. I want to talk about specifically the economic impacts of the response to COVID. And you've touched on that. But before you do that, can you just kind of give us a quick primer on government deficits and what that can mean economically? What's the impact?
Oh, government deficits. Fun times. Yeah. So our government likes to spend money. And no one likes to pay taxes.
I think that's
how we live, right? Who doesn't like to spend
right
without paying taxes? And there's some optimal level of spending, optimal level of deficits the government can run. People oftentimes ask me, well, don't we need to balance our budget? And I kind of say, well, let me ask you this. If you could borrow at 3%, you know, take a home loan out at 3% and put it in the stock market or put it in some relatively safe funds that generate 8-9%, would you? And everyone would answer, yeah. Well, in some ways, that's what our government's able to do, right? They're able to borrow at relatively low percents, and they can choose to spend it on infrastructure projects or other public works things, or they can choose to give it to us in lower taxes, right? Now, you don't want them to do that for large amounts of money, but certainly small, modest deficits, that would make sense, right? Like, hey, go borrow $500 billion this year and keep my taxes $500 billion lower so we can use that money to invest, buy housing, and buy stock. So, I mean, so some degree of deficits is I think most economists would argue is relatively safe. And that's what we've done. Right. Since Bill Clinton back in 99, where we had a surplus for a hot second, we ran deficits. And the causes of those deficits have been wars, some tax policies, recessions. You know, we had a big one in 2007. So we run deficits, and it's usually politically feasible to run deficits and politically desirable to run deficits. And that's fine. President Trump was no different, right? He ran deficits, was one of the first presidents to see our deficits.
And real quickly, so I want to distinguish one thing, right? When you're talking about deficits, or when we talk about deficits, we're talking about spending more than we bring in taxes.
Yes, in a given year.
As opposed to, which we might get to later, trade deficits.
Yes.
So, and this is my bad for not being, but no, okay, so go on. Okay, no, President Trump.
But government deficits, and President Trump was one of the first presidents that when we actually had falling unemployment is typically when you expect deficits to fall. There's not as much need to for the government to borrow. We saw deficits start to increase. And then the Biden administration through COVID and post-COVID, those deficits exploded to about $2 trillion a year, which is a big chunk. And again, when you talk about deficits, I'm not worried about the sheer size of it. I'm worried more about how much it costs to borrow to pay interest on it. And is it sustainable? All those sorts of questions. And at the end of the day, people got scared that we had taken, you take the sum of all those deficits and you add it up and you get $30 trillion. And that's the level of our debt, right? And so now there is this sort of other kind of anxiety. And I think, again, there's anxiety around that number because it sounds really big and scary. And it is a really big and scary number.
I can't get my mind around that. I'm gonna look at how many zeros
that. I think the total level of federal debt right now is floating somewhere around $35-36 trillion. It's a lot of zeros.
Anyway, go on,
sir. Well, and so I mean, I think there was certainly a need to have some due diligence around how we are spending our money. Mm-hmm. I think if you were to talk to a lot of Americans, especially younger Americans that kind of are feeling a little overwhelmed by this, and they somehow feel like they need to get this $36 trillion down to nothing in a short period of time. And we don't. That will not be our policy goal, but we need to be mindful, right? How many zeros is it?
13. Yeah. So 3 and then 13 zeros or 30 and 12 zeros.
Yeah.
Wow. It's a big number.
Yeah. And that thing was also partly some of the reason, you know, again, looking at where we are today and what's going on, people want to see that deficit, the annual deficit, get under control a little bit more and maybe chip away at the debt a little bit, which I would argue, as long as interest rates stay relatively low, we don't need to lower the level of debt, right? Because our economy is going to keep growing anyway.
What about this argument that the U.S. dollar is the world currency and therefore debt doesn't matter because we can keep printing?
I think we started to see a little bit of that mentality and potentially some of the risks of doing so. I think when you look at the amount of spending that the government did in COVID and you add in all of the monetary stimulus, the low interest rates, and you look at the amount of money, the dollars that entered the economy, that certainly is partly what drove the inflation. People had so much money saved up, so much money coming in through these stimulus measures that we couldn't keep up with production at the end of the day. And something had to give, and it was prices. So, I mean, I think there's some truth to that we still have some ability to, you know, use the printing press a little bit, keep interest rates a little bit lower maybe, and help kind of juice the economy a little bit. But I think we're a little bit more cautious of that because I don't think the Federal Reserve doesn't want a repeat of 2022, right?
Yeah, but does that ever come to a head? Like when I'm slamming espressos all day and getting a kick, but at some point, 9 o'clock, I'm just going to fall flat on my
Well, face. That was, there's a couple Fed quotes out there, when the tide goes out, you'll see who's swimming naked, right?
Yeah.
Kind of. And that's sort of their job. And you look at the Federal Reserve, we always kind of joke, they're the ones that are responsible for taking the punch bowl away from the party just when the party's getting good, right? So you don't want that hangover effect. And arguably, they probably...
You don't see that guy.
No, you don't want to be that guy. No one likes that guy. But arguably, they kind of failed at doing that in 2022. They let the punch be out there a little bit too long. People drank a little too much punch and enjoyed themselves, bought a few extra bottles. And next thing we know, we're dealing with the ramifications of the 9% inflation.
How does crypto fall into this too? Is that a completely different...
Well, I mean, I think
I wouldn't all into crypto. Was that a bad idea?
I mean, when did you buy? Did you buy before the...
last week. I cashed out the 401k.
I think the thing with crypto is there's so much instability in that market. And in COVID, it became a giant game for people because, again, they had so much money come in. At the end of the day, they were looking at ways to, get rich quick. And Robinhood, I mean, it was like crack for some of these kids. Totally. I would say kids.
Gamification.
It was a gamification of gambling. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And
you could buy like crazy hedge maneuver, like different. It was
And so
colored options, and it's, and like some 18-year-old and is like,
is there a place for alternative currencies, currencies that could be a competition to the US dollar? Mm-hmm. Yes. I'm not sure we're there yet. I don't know if the current cryptocurrencies that are being, that are out there, are going to serve that purpose. Bitcoin, one of the biggest challenges with Bitcoin is very few merchants accept it. And when you walk into a coffee shop and you see the price of a coffee is 0.000482 Bitcoin, do you have a clue of what that is? How much are you spending?
Is that for real? That happens?
There are some places that, well, you can pay in cryptocurrency in Bitcoin and they will be denominated, the good will be denominated in Bitcoin.
Isn't there a limit to the number of Bitcoin? That's
21 million is the limit.
So that could be a problem.
And so that's sort of the thought process is you've almost hit that point, right? I think we're either close to 20 million coins being manufactured.
Well,
I think it's 20. It might be.
You know, there was in accounting, on the accounting side, there was thought early, and it has not, is yet to come to fruition, of value in the blockchain, not Bitcoin. Yep. For your ledgers and all that, and being unable to do certain things, and then using technologies for your audit, but I don't get the crypto, I don't get the value, I don't get it as outside of an accounting.
I think there are some really valuable uses of the technology, especially when you look at a globalized economy where you have people constantly buying and selling stuff in other countries. And traditionally, the speed at which it takes to take dollars and bring it over to China, or take yuan and bring it to the US, it takes time. Mm-hmm. And so I think there is some use to using some of these technologies, technologies that can speed up that process. Because with time and foreign exchange, there's always risk that your exchange rates are going to move, right, or you need to charge a premium in case, you know, to in case they do move, right?
Right.
And so I do think there's some valuable use of cryptocurrency. I think right now it's just because it's such a speculative environment, so many people are looking for the, you know, Bitcoin to a million, which if Bitcoin hits a million, its market cap would be $200 trillion, more than every single company traded publicly in the United States.
And is it a company?
Well, that's just it. What should it be, right? Like at the end of the day. But I mean, you know.
And who's, I mean, who monitors that Bitcoin price? I'm curious about this.
Like, it's market, supply and demand.
But someone's got to have a server somewhere doing something.
Exchanges.
86,409.86 right now.
And that's been a roller coaster, right? Talking about the Trump administration, that jumped up when he was elected to close to 110, dipped back down to 77, and it's been all over the board.
I mean, just today it's gone from, looks like a little like 91 all the way down to 86.
So, I mean, until some of the stability kicks in, I don't think we'll see a lot of value in that in terms of being used as a currency, right? But that gets into a lot of the kind of today, in this administration, we've had President Trump come out and talk about a strategic crypto reserve. Mm-hmm. We've had him come out talking about that they were going to remove capital gains taxes on crypto gains. We've had some exchanges no longer need to report crypto transactions to the IRS. So it's just creating more and more speculation in those markets. And I think the kind of big theme needs to be, we need less volatility in markets. We need less volatility and uncertainty in policy. And right now, we're getting a lot of uncertainty in our policies. And that's my worry for our economy, right? It's hard to plan when every day there's some change to an economic policy.
Yeah, I mean, so we're there now talking about our current economy under our current president. And so maybe you could tell us more about how tariffs are proposed. And I know every day it seems to change, but maybe the purpose behind that and the intentionality and how that may impact the economy.
Yes. So part of the administration's campaign was on tariffs. We've all heard this. And we know with President Trump in his first term as president, he did levy tariffs on steel coming into the U.S. and a lot of Chinese goods. And for perspective, I mentioned this, we're about a $30 trillion economy. And those tariffs in his first term hit about $400 billion of stuff. But they were also short-lived, right? There was some negotiations in there. China agreed to buy more agriculture from the United States in exchange to remove some of these tariffs. But given kind of fast forward COVID a little bit, the growing concerns of the deficits, the government trade or the government deficits, there's been kind of a rethink of how we can use tariffs. Mm-hmm. And there's been lots of arguments given out for why we need tariffs. We've heard we need tariffs so we can bring back manufacturing to the U.S. Tariffs that protect goods of national interest, I think, are a different type of a tariff. So we want a steel industry. If we think we need that for national security purposes, then let's have a steel industry. If we need a semiconductor facility to make, you know, silicone wafers so we can have semiconductor chips, then let's protect those industries and provide subsidies so those companies can succeed in the U.S. So there's that argument that's been made over the need for tariffs. And I think most people say, sure, that's fine. That's relatively small. It's not going to have a huge impact at the household level. Now we're starting to see more of these broad-based tariffs. We've heard these tariffs are retaliatory because other countries tariff U.S. goods. So we're just going to put the tariffs on these countries as retaliation. And then we've heard these tariffs are going to be used so we can help reduce income taxes, right? We're going to use them as a big tax revenue source. So we've had a lot of sort of reasons for why these tariffs need to occur. And you can kind of, the national interest or national security interests, those make sense. The retaliation for tariffs on U.S. goods, that's what the WTO is designed to do, is to permit, if we find a country is taxing our goods, you can file a claim with the WTO to give you a right to retaliate in a fair way. But then at the same time, when we start talking about can tariffs be used to help reduce income taxes? And most people think they're going to do a modest amount and that the overall impact of the household is probably a negative, because the two debates we're having is really, can tariffs raise enough government revenue? But then also, will tariffs be inflationary? And most economists are on board with the impact on government revenue is going to be relatively small. And yes, we do think they're going to raise prices. We do think inflation is going to be a little bit higher. And the concern there is to the household, okay, you're now paying more for stuff, but also that's going to limit the Federal Reserve's ability to kind of lower interest rates a little bit, which is really what people want right now. And the Fed just said, we're not lowering interest rates. We're going to stand pat to see what the effects are of immigration and tariffs are on our economy. So they're waiting to see how inflation shakes out over the next few months before they move anyway. But yeah. And then you throw in the other element of, are tariffs going to bring back manufacturing?
Yeah. Or protect American jobs.
Protect American jobs. Yeah. And most of it is to bring back jobs. Mm-hmm. And most companies are really, really reluctant to go spend billions of dollars of capital expenditures based on the thought a tariff is going to stay in place. Just in the last 2 months, we've had the announcement of tariffs. Then a day later, we had the removal of tariffs, mm-hmm, for a month. And then we announced tariffs. And then we removed tariffs, and then we announced them again. And then, so it's really hard.
And removed them for certain industries, yep. for automotive, for cars, for certain things, right?
For the yeah. farmers, for to bring in potash, mm-hmm. for fertilizer. So it's just creating so much uncertainty. We have an economic policy uncertainty index that is now the highest it's ever been, except for the pandemic.
Wow.
So there's more policy uncertainty today than the Great Recession, than 9/11, than the this started in 1984 for perspective. So, I mean, when we were kids and.
I'm a little younger than you.
I know.
I was your student once. I mean,
that was this policy index really shows how much uncertainty we are dealing with when you look at these events that we're dealing with today. I mean, you had two Gulf Wars in there. You had three or four recessions in there. And we have more uncertainty now than we've had outside just the pandemic, which we're quickly approaching the pandemic levels of uncertainty.
Very interesting.
Speaking of current policies, can you just talk a little bit about the economic impact of immigration, including illegal immigration? I had heard recently that the flow of people across the border, at least across the land border, has slowed significantly, and what that might mean from an economic perspective.
Yeah, and economic professions kind of back themselves into a bit of a corner in the view of immigration. For a lot of studies early on, we looked at how immigration into the U.S. affects wages and affects employment in the U.S. And most of these studies really found that immigration to the U.S. had really minor effects on wages in those given industries. Usually it was good for tax base. It would provide labor and therefore more tax income, and wasn't a huge detriment to kind of native U.S. workers, that they were coming in complementary industries that U.S. workers weren't wanting to engage in, industries that, you know, farming and, you know, meat production and things like that, meatpacking plants. And so now we're kind of seeing maybe if those studies were true, then we wouldn't expect to see big effects on wages and things like that if all of a sudden there's a massive outflow of labor. But I think we're kind of seeing the opposite. We're seeing instances in which farmers can't find labor anymore, right? We see builders down south not finding labor anymore. There's stories, more and more stories coming in saying there's labor shortages in many of these industries. So I don't know how long that lasts. I don't know if the U.S. Labor is able to come in and substitute. My suspicion is we don't have that labor on hand. Not many, I would imagine, people want to go work in meatpacking plants or go work, you know, hanging drywall when it's 100 degrees outside.
I've hung drywall. It lasted about 2 weeks. It was awful.
2 weeks. It was misery. Right? Go roof a house in the middle of the desert.
What was that TV show that was really popular like a decade or two ago? Like Dirtiest Jobs or something?
And Micro. He still does some of that stuff, yeah. Right? Mm-hmm. And those are really challenging, difficult jobs. And they're jobs that are critical to our economy. Mm-hmm. And for Brasich to go hang drywall, he needs to be paid a small fortune. But we don't want to pay Brasich that fortune because we want our houses to be relatively affordable, right?
I mean, after tax, $650,000 a year just to keep me in the lifestyle I've come accustomed to. So
yeah, so I mean, so that's what I mean, right? So mm-hmm. if that's the challenge we run up against, is we want our meat prices to stay low.
Yeah.
Right.
Our cost of eggs.
We want our cost of eggs, agricultural stuff, to remain low. Mm-hmm. And I'm all in favor of, hey, can we get Americans into these jobs if those jobs are open? But the cost of doing so is going to raise those prices significantly, which again goes back to that kind of some of those inflationary concerns that people already have.
Absolutely.
So, I mean, again, immigration. Yeah, I don't want fentanyl coming across the border. I want people coming here legally. I just see that we have a need for these people, for these immigrants to come in and be vital parts of our community and be vital parts of our labor force to contribute. And they want to be contributing. So, I mean, again, that's more, I mean, there's certainly enough economic literature to support kind of those views, but I think you start looking at the value they provide and it's much larger, right? At least on the ones that have come in legally than the costs.
Right. Can we transition to DOGE and maybe some of the government layoffs and how that may affect the economy?
Yeah, let's do it.
Okay. So I am just curious because, you know, as people now have been taking these layoff options, is this having the intended result or is it making some of these government agencies unable to function because they don't have enough people? Or what are we seeing in terms of the effect of this? Is it saving us so much money and it's making us more efficient? Or what are we seeing early now?
DOGE, oh boy. so I think we all agree. We don't want government wasting taxpayer dollars.
Yeah.
Right. I think ultimately on a lot of the programs that are being cut, the words fraud and waste are being thrown around a little judiciously. And I think we had values change, right? Mm-hmm. And obviously this election changed a lot of, you know, I don't want to say our values change, but how people voted certainly sent a signal that we want to be using our money in different ways. And that's fine. And so we want to go through and be careful to make sure we spend our money in ways that as a country, we truly value. Going through, and I think what we are learning is when you have a $2 trillion deficit, a government budget of $6.5 to $7 trillion, that's complex. And it's really difficult to just go in and say, okay, we're just going to shut this system down for the day. And then all of a sudden, people aren't able to get Medicaid payments doled out or other systems, vital systems get shut down. So the government is incredibly complex and it's going to take time to find these wastes when there truly are wastes. And I think there was just this rush and impatience to report big numbers. Mm-hmm. Not that these big numbers aren't going to come at some point down the road, but right now, DOGE is reporting $100 billion, right? And it's not verified yet. That's what we saw. A lot of the bigger ticket items have already been clawed back. But even if you think of $100 billion, that is in the contracts that they terminated over a number of years. So on an annualized basis, you're talking maybe $30 or $40 billion. Let's just use $30 billion. For ease. And when you're talking a $2 trillion deficit and you're looking at $30 billion, again, those are $30 billion is a big number. $2 trillion is a massive number, right? So you just start lopping off zeros and all of a sudden you're like, well, $2 trillion to $30 billion. Well, that's like $2 billion to $30 million. That's like $2 million to $30,000. Like, yeah, that's but it's nowhere near what we need. And again, great, it's something, but it's nowhere near what we need. And that's the challenge. What we need to address are the big spending items. Social Security. No, we do not have 3 million people, 300, whatever that number was, 3 million people over the age of 150 collecting Social Security. Mm-hmm. It came out there are 90,000 people over the age of 99 collecting Social Security, which seems reasonable.
Good run.
I mean, it's a great run, but we need to look at Social Security. You need to look at your tax policy. You need to look at Medicare, Medicaid, and defense, right? Those things make up the majority of your budget.
Yeah.
And ultimately, if you are serious about getting the deficit under control, DOGE going in, looking at contracts, terminating subscriptions to Politico or Bloomberg terminals they aren't using, or even that they are using. I think they just terminated all Bloomberg terminal contracts. Mm-hmm. That's not going to make much of a dent in that deficit, and unless you want to address the harder things, mm-hmm. which is money going to people, and people aren't going to like that. So Doge sort of seems like this kind of fun thing to look at and watch and distract from the actual challenges of getting the deficit under control. And those challenges are real. And I don't suspect Doge is going to be able to really make a dent in those deficits unless you get some structural reform from Congress.
I'm going to give you a choice A and a choice B. And you have 2 seconds to answer.
I'm ready. Around it. I need rapid fire. I can't have. Okay. Stephanie's going to get this. Okay. Hawks or Packers?
Seahawks.
Skiing or snowboarding?
Skiing.
North Side or South Hill?
North Side.
Premier League or La Liga?
Premier League.
Alaska Airlines or Delta?
Delta. Lost some followers with that one.
Lost a lot of followers there. Beer or wine?
Beer. Bourbon.
And this is the most important one. In the WCC tourney, Zags or Gales?
Zags.
You got...
I feel like you were pitting me against someone on that.
You got a 50% on that.
Well, 50%. Yeah. 50%. Well done.
You were one time a Packer season ticket holder, is that correct?
Or your my wife's family was, yeah.
And your wife's also a Gale, so you married a Packer and a Gale.
Yes.
Okay, that is correct, he says.
That is correct, yes.
How about here's another one, mountains or sound?
Sound.
Sound, so the Gabe Harbor guy likes sound. Or like the water. I get a little bit of both there, too.
Oh, you do, I like the water. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
And you grow up on the water.
I'm with you actually on Delta. I feel like Alaska Airlines is kind of, don't know what's happened in the last 5 or 10 years. It's just not the same as it used to be. So
it's a little regional too, because I've lived in other places. And so it's great here, but if, you know, if you're on the East Coast or
right,
you're in the Midwest, it's just not available.
But we just like to go to Hawaii.
We just fly over the no.
Well, they bought Hawaiian Airlines. Alaska.
They bought Hawaiian, and
Virgin Atlantic at one point. They merged too.
Virgin Atlantic gave them a little bit more of California, Hawaii. There's going to enable them to compete a little bit more with Delta on the Asian flights.
Okay.
So we're going to see a little less competition on those flights to Hawaii.
Okay.
A little higher prices flying to.
I feel it used to be like the gold standard. Like you'd have a friend from the East Coast come over, and it used to be like a simple flight. Like this. It's nice. It worked out great.
They gave me free beer and wine.
Yeah. The key is it, particularly if you're on the regional Horizon flights, you take that very back row.
Because you get the last bottle.
Because when the flight attendant comes back and she's got like that big bottle, she'll be like, I got to do something with it. She'll just hand it to you.
This.
A big secret. Okay. But now everybody knows because the 24 people listen to this podcast.
I was about to say, what's our listener count? Yeah.
Yeah, I agree. The sounds pretty nice. Do you miss home at all? I should say home, but where you're from?
I'm a Washingtonian. Yeah. So, I mean, I grew up in the Pacific Northwest. There's you know, being in Gig Harbor, Eugene, now Spokane, there's elements to all three that I love. There's elements to all three that I've learned to appreciate their value in. But yeah, not being around the Sound and Gig Harbor, for those that have never been there, once you're there, you kind of see like why it got as popular as it did, right? You sit there, you look at Mount Rainier, you have the water, you have lots of cool things. It's definitely grown a lot since when I was a kid. When I was a kid, there was one grocery store and I think one stoplight in town.
Oh.
And I think it's probably one of the top 10 bars in America. Zog's on, is it Fox Island?
It's on Fox Island.
On Fox Island. It's amazing.
Don't give my brother that much credit. I want to say top 10, but it's a fun spot to go when you're out there.
I'm a professor if I say it. It's true. It's top 10. I haven't been there yet. But yeah.
Three out of three professors agree.
Yeah.
Well, we're kind of coming towards the end of time. Is there anything you want to like that we didn't talk about that you'd like to say, or you want to close and wrap up or anything with respect to that?
I mean, I think when we talk about the economy, I think one of the things we are seeing is this, I think social media is part of this. These stories are very quick to be produced without necessarily fact checking, and they get magnified very, very quickly. And right now there seems to be a lot of conspiracies around economic data, it being not realistic or fake or fabricated. And I think I push people to, if an economic statistic's being produced and you don't agree with it, don't instantly jump to the, oh, it's wrong. This is a conspiracy. It's, you know, it's to increase, you know, Joe Biden's odds of winning the election or things like that, or it's to harm President Trump. It's to spend a minute. Don't go on to X, Twitter, go on to social media. Spend a minute. Ask someone, what does this mean? Because I think we're very quick to use social media to justify our prior beliefs. And when you search in Twitter, is the inflation rate bias? You will get everyone confirming your belief. I don't believe the unemployment rate today was 4.1%. And this goes for both sides of the aisle. You will go on there and you will get people confirming your belief. So I think that's the big point is we need to do better at data literacy, economic literacy, so people can, when they don't believe something, instead of running with that disbelief, come talk to someone that can help explain it.
It's a great takeaway.
Plug for our us.
Yeah. I was about to say, is that what you hope your students get out of your classes?
No, I'm looking at one. For those that don't know, I think I had Stephanie, what year was it? 2007 as a student.
Yeah, I had a moment where a student was telling me about your son needing to get your car keys and interrupting your class. And then I did the math and realized he probably wasn't even born when I was your student.
He was decidedly not born. Yeah. Decidedly not born. Decidedly not.
Yeah. Well, so it's been a while, but yes, that's good to know that's the takeaway.
Yeah. Well, Dr. Ryan Herzog, W. Herzog, what's the middle name?
William.
William. Okay. And social security number. No, I'm just kidding. You have to go
there. Yeah. Mother's maiden name.
Macroeconomist here at Gonzaga. And the name of your textbook?
Just Principles of Economics.
Principles of Economics with Paul Krugman, Nobel laureate. Appreciate your time and your expertise. Always good to see you, buddy. And onward and upward.
Appreciate it.
This podcast has been a production of the Gonzaga University School of Business Administration and was edited by Colby Verhoeven. Thank you to our hosts, Professors Stephanie Van Dellen and Andrew Brasich, and thank you for joining us.
Rock and roll. Today, we're very lucky to have one of our experts from the School of Business Administration. And you're kind of half in the College of Arts and Sciences too with the Herzog, I mean with the economics degree. Your name is Herzog, but yeah.
You want to re-record this?
We'll be editing that out. Well, what is that now? Wow.
Strong start.
So cool. We just do that little quick intro, cut out whatever was on the College of Arts.